Blog Talk Radio.
Dog Works Training Centers, professional canine training center in Denver, Colorado, presents Mush, You Huskies, a show about dog-powered sports and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Mush, You Huskies, is part of Twine Group Media and syndicated worldwide on blogtalkradio.com. Here's your host, Dr. Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto hosting Day 7 coverage of the Iditarod from Willow, Alaska. And I have on the line our co-host, Michelle. And if we could get Jason, our Iditarod expert, to call back in, we're having some problems pulling him up in the queue. So, Jason, if you would, please call back in and we'll get you right back on the air. Michelle, how are you?
I'm doing great.
What is going on down in Denver?
It was another beautiful day, about 66 degrees. We will be down in the freezing temperatures tonight and probably in the low 50s tomorrow. But, you know, Denver, if you get a blast of snow through, it's going to melt off the ground these days.
That's exactly right. And on the line, we do have our co-host, Jason Barron, on the line. Jason, can you hear me?
I can. I was having some technical difficulties on my end, but I am here now.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. How is it in Lincoln today?
Oh, we're having a good day. Still very warm and a little bit windy. And I tell you, this is the day where I've been jonesing for being out on the Iditarod Trail the most. I mean, it's been kind of creeping up on me. But I tell you, watching all those videos and reading all the statistics, and today I'm really wishing I was on the Iditarod Trail.
So what is the deal with that? Are you planning on being back in the any time near future, or what's your plans?
Well, I'm only committing to having taken 2 to 3 years off, probably 3 years, this being one of them. And the big thing was, as I told you and I told many people, is I wanted to give my riding career a chance to at least get started before I take off with my dogs again. And we have a very new family. My family, we're basically working on kids as we speak. My youngest is 20 months old. I have a 4.5-year-old. My wife is with child again, so we're definitely in the middle of raising a family. So this was just a good time for me to not be gone all the time, you know, battering my head against the all the tough guys like you and Lance and Sebastian out there running the dogs, and do a kind of a home-based kind of work thing, which is writing. And I've already got the one novel out, Ballad of the Northland. Crazy great reviews. People are really eating it up and saying a lot of positive things, and I'm already at work on two other projects as we speak.
So I do know there are quite a few musher families out there with several that are young kids. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about that, about how difficult it is for mom and dad to be away for not only the 2 or 3 weeks that the Iditarod encompasses, but those hundreds and hundreds of training days that you are, you know, in and out of home while you're doing that? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I can only speak from my experiences. Some families are, dog mushing families are no different in that regard than any American family. They're all set up along different dynamics. I can only speak about mine. And I would say that I have taken the hit. When my wife got pregnant with our eldest back in 06, she went from being my best sort of like, she was my kennel partner. She was a woman that was training the other half of the team. I mean, we were partners as much as we were a married couple. And, I mean, she got very sick. Her pregnancy, she was very ill for about the first trimester. I mean, just like bedridden, kind of just horribly ill. And as soon as she got pregnant with Oksana back in 06, that was it. I mean, it was like from that moment on, I went from before that I'd had a partner and helped me run the dogs and a handler, and then I went boom down to no help at all, not so much as cleaning dogs or feeding or doing anything. So what's happened since then is harm has been 100%. She's just completely dropped the whole dog mushing thing, and she's completely turned into just the mother. And with that said, I have been the one that's been out there running the dogs, and, you know, if someone has to be gone, then that's it. So when we go racing and stuff, it's really not a case of the kids have to be without mom. Mom is always with, you'll never see my wife without her kids. you'll see me without them because I have to be off doing paddle, but she's always with them. It just puts a lot of strain on us because it's, you know, anybody, this is just a crazy business. You are not, I mean, it's just an amazing amount of work that really goes into this. And I get to the point where when I'm preparing for the Iditarod, I'm probably putting in 17, 18 hour days, 7 days a week, all from Christmas, past, before Christmas, all the way up past the Iditarod.
So it is a family business, so to speak, but it's also, like you said, just about every other American family out there where we are separated at times when we do need to be at home. So I know it makes it difficult. I'm going through some of the same things that you're going through now, and I understand that totally. So let's get into day 7 of the Iditarod, and we want to cover a couple of things that we mentioned yesterday. One thing about teams that could possibly quit out on the trail, and I know you have a great story to talk about when a sled can literally shred into pieces on some of this hectic trail that is called Iditarod. But before we do that, what is the up-to-the-minute updates on the leaders and some of the other goings-on in this year's race, Jason?
Well, I think what we're seeing is that front group, as we had talked about, as I predicted, was going to, you know, we were going to see a few of them splinter off and from the run from Iditarod. A few were going to splinter off and stop in Shagluck, which would set them up for passing Anvik and going on to Grayling and then on to Eagle. And then some of the drivers, and it turned out the bulk of them in that front group, would go straight from Iditarod, pass up Eagle Island, and go to Anvik, which essentially really what that means is that they can go from Anvik to Eagle Island, just like the drivers that are going to be sitting in Grayling can go to Eagle Island, with this crucial difference. They didn't need 2 to 5 hours of rest that some of the folks who stopped in Shagluck really added to their count. Now what that means is those drivers who sort of stopped just before Shagluck, like Sebastian did, or, you know, Hans, Gott, and Dallas have stopped in Shagluck and then are going to continue on and are continuing on to Grayling, is that they made a move that was very kind of a pro move in terms of just going, look, I'm letting the competition go, and I want to make sure that dog team is a solid, sound dog team. I want to be rocking and rolling up the river, and none of this potential quit kind of scenario stuff happening. I'm not going to worry about what those front runners are doing, because as I said before, what those front runners are doing is they have this loaded gun and they're just kind of handing it back and forth to see who lucks out first. And it's only a matter of time until you start seeing those drivers potentially, well, I some of them will get away with it and some of them won't. It's almost impossible to guess. And with the strategy from someone like, say, Dallas Seavey, who's now out of the picture by many hours, what his strategy is, he's saying to the world, my team looks perfect. I think you guys are going to fall apart and your teams are going to be barely moving, and I'm still going to be moving at my 9 to 10 miles an hour, and I'm going to pass you because you're going to be parked somewhere with your hood up and steam coming out of your engine compartment while I go loping by. Now, the only problem with that, and what I'll say, I think it's a great strategy because I think guys like, Hans and Sebastian and Dallas, for instance, are going to have some of the best, strongest runs and best time standing on the runners all the way to Nome from here, whereas some of the people in front of them, even by many hours, are probably going to have some fairly agonizing trips to Nome. It's really tough to push a limp noodle to Nome, I'll tell you that, and some of these teams are going to start turning into limp noodles. But the problem is this, is that one or two teams that did that run to Anvik and is heading up to Eagle Island, you know, kind of now, are going to get away with it. A law of averages, somebody is going to get away with it, which means that it's unlikely that we're going to see Dallas or Sab or Hans win.
So when you say limp noodle, what does that mean exactly in mushing parlance?
Well, we, you know, as fans, and I'm just seeing this now, I've always been in the thick of it, so... As I'm seeing this now, I interact with the fans quite a bit, and I'm all over different social medias, and I do a lot of website work, and I go into a lot of schools. I think one thing the public, what people who don't run, especially distance dogs, understand is that this isn't a Hugh Neff race, and it isn't a Jason Barron race, Lance Mackey, or a Jeff King race. We're the people standing the runners taking all of the credit for this amazing stuff that these sled dogs do. The sled dogs are the sled dogs are essentially every aspect of the car that we're racing. In other words, and if they fail, if there's mechanical failure, if they don't want to do it, then things start to fall apart. And I sort of liken it to a limp noodle. If a team gets to the point where it doesn't really want to go, they haven't quit, but they just don't really want to go as much anymore. They need excessive amounts of rest, because once you've gone over a certain limit with them, you can't really get them back on the race while you're still trying to be competitive. They almost need a couple of weeks at home to recharge their batteries. And that's when it's like they haven't quit, but you're pretty close to that, and it's like pushing a limp noodle. And I mean it sort of almost like tongue-in-cheek. I mean, they're getting down the trail. You're having to take these excessive rests. I mean, you get up and you go. But if you try to keep making these gladiator kind of pushes that we're seeing, strong teams making in the first half of the race, well, then that's when you start seeing teams, sputter out and not finish.
So, Jason, Michelle has something to add exactly on that point. Michelle?
Yeah, I'm noticing that a few of the top runners that are still in ANVIC have actually went ahead and taken their 8-hour layover, as has Dallas, but Dallas is still in Shagluck. So I'm wondering how his strategy is going to pan out, because mushers like Neff, Baker, Mackey, Reddington, and Boozer have all taken their 8-hour layovers, but they're already a checkpoint ahead of him. And Dallas took his 8-hour layover as well. So for me, looking at this again as an amateur for sure, I'm seeing that those guys right there already taking their 8-hour mandatory and their 24-hour mandatory are really going to set the stage for the next few days. Sebastian and Hans have not taken their 8-hour layovers as far as the standings show right now.
And Jason, before you respond to that, I know a lot of people, when they're trying to follow these standings on the internet, they don't understand the timing dynamics of these 8 hours and these 24-hour layovers. So can you tell us a little bit about that in just a couple of minutes? I know this morning Sebastian really went out and took the lead, so to speak, while some other guys were resting, including Hugh Neff, who claimed the prize for the first one to the Yukon, which is a big dinner and even $3,500 in cash.
Mm-hmm.
But he wasn't necessarily going to be the leader for long. So can you explain that a little bit?
Well, okay, yeah, I sure can. Look, what the audience needs to understand, and I think the audience is probably kind of split down the middle. Some people pay attention, watch this stuff obsessively and really, have this insider kind of insight, and some of them don't, and that's fine. It is very complicated. I know people have been watching this stuff for years. It's hard to follow because this race doesn't have the typical structure of an event where they're all starting from point A at the same time, and then they go to point B and shut down for the night, and then you're constantly just judging them based on their trail time. In this race, it's very free-form. And you got people stopping in checkpoints. You got people stopping out of checkpoints. You got people. This race, I'll tell you, and I saw that, I won't belabor the point, but I saw some stuff come up on the social media today that I just have to kind of cover this. Right now, the Iditarod, the bush race, there's no road system. There's no way to drive a truck and personnel to any of these checkpoints. It's stretched between more checkpoints than the Yukon Quest has in its entirety, from start, from the last driver who's sitting on his 24 in McGrath to the front driver who's out of ANVIC. It's stretched between more checkpoints than the entire Yukon Quest has. So from a logistical standpoint, this is a bloody nightmare for the race people to keep up with, much less all of us fans. So what I would say is just everybody that doesn't understand fully what's going on, just take a deep breath and go, hardly anybody does. I mean, only people have been doing this for years and really obsessively watch this stuff, like have a true grasp on it. Now, what I would say is what you're seeing is what I call the yo-yo effect. You see this thing where someone goes by someone else, and they're physically in front, but the insider who's been crunching the numbers knows that person has to stop at such and such point of the day and take X amount of rest, and that someone behind them, physically behind them, is resting a checkpoint, is set up to take off and past that person while they're resting, and they can go even further down the trail. And then while they're resting, the person that's now behind them can pass them while they're on the trail. So it really what it is, you have to look at it kind of like a chess game and go, okay, how is this all going to play out? I mean, where does it end up? I mean, if they're all just heading for Nome, where does Sebastian and Dallas and Hugh and, you know, where do all these things, you know, where do they even out? Well, I'm going to go back to answering, okay, and of course so the audience knows, there is an 8-hour mandatory break. It means the race says you have to stay somewhere for 8 hours. But starting from Shagluck, you can stay at either Shagluck, Anvik, Eagle Island, or Caltag. Now, that's where the race currently is. Shagluck and Anvik is kind of where everybody's going through. So now back to, take a deep breath here, back to Michelle's point, which is, well, to her it looks like Dallas is behind, basically. And she's right, absolutely. Dallas is behind. Dallas has fallen off of the lead pace. Hugh Neff, as of Anvik, is far and away, and the teams that started coming in there right straight through behind him with the intention of staying there are officially in the lead. And even though that Sebastian and Hans kind of passed those front runners like Hugh while they were taking their eights, we know that the yo-yo effect means that Sebastian and Hans were just going to go about 20 miles up the trail, 18 miles up the trail, stay in Grayling for eight, and would still be sitting there, which they still are, when Hugh and John Baker and, you know, some of these drivers like Ray Reddington Jr. start smoking out of Anvik and then pass them up, more yo-yoing, on their way to Eagle Island. The good news is this will all start evening out for the front group. It'll start evening out at Eagle Island, because I don't think anyone's going to pass Eagle Island. There's nowhere to camp out there on the Yukon. And the only real shelter is in that one spot where the checkpoint is of Eagle Island. So basically all these teams coming from Grayling, Sebastian, et cetera, and the teams coming from Anvik are going, they're all going to Eagle Island. So the good news is it'll sort of, for a while anyway, it'll simplify itself. We'll be able to more easily figure out what people are doing. So when Sebastian pulls into Eagle Island and takes however much rest he's going to take and he takes off, we'll be able to contrast, technically speaking, what he's doing against Hugh. It'll be easier for us to understand what the relationship between him and Hugh Neff, who's our current leader, in my opinion. Hugh Neff was running one of the strongest, fastest, one of the bigger teams coming in, first driver in Danvik. And, you know, like I said on my blog this morning, I mean, people have been asking me, why aren't you paying more attention to Hugh? And I said, well, you know, Hugh is, I've been kind of holding my breath. From number one, I don't want to jinx the poor guy. Everybody I've picked so far has had some problems. So, you know, I've kind of held my breath until now. Hugh is looking strong. Hugh's looking like the leader of the race.
So go ahead and take a breath there, Jason. That was a big commentary there. So before we get into teams that quit on the trail, I want to kind of give people an idea. There was a musher, I don't know if it was last year or the year before, who was in safety, which is the checkpoint right before Nome, and his team pretty much quit on him, and he was getting ready to scratch, and he didn't quite understand the whole logistics of you have to talk to the race marshal before you can actually scratch. So what ended up happening is one of the snow machine guys said, hey, why don't you just start walking and your dogs might follow you? It's only 20 miles or however far it is from safety. You know, you could literally walk from this checkpoint to that checkpoint, and I guarantee your dogs will follow you if they know that you are, you know, in front of them. And they're going to say, hey, wait a second, this guy is supposed to be behind us, not in front of us. So if you can, Jason, tell us about what happens if a dog team just says, you know what, guy, I'm done, you know, we aren't going any farther. Can you explain that a little bit?
Well, there's all different levels. You know, I'll try. There's all different levels of quitting. And I will say this. It's something that happens. It's something that happens usually, for the most part. It's something that happens to the least experienced drivers who just don't really have that good of teams and then don't know how to, you know, not that quality of dogs, not that highly trained. They don't have the knowledge to properly manage them on the trail. And they get themselves in these quit scenarios. And there's all different ways that this can manifest itself. My limp noodle smoking, kind of smoke boiling off from under the hood analogy, you know, goes from a smart driver feels that starting to happen and then kind of backs off. And I've been there before. I've taken teams. And then the other end of the spectrum is the competitive driver who has pushed. And, you know, all these guys that were and gals who were driving so hard to get to Iditarod from Katna and then now Anvik and now Eagle, and it just kind of snowballs, just keeps on going until you either can do it or you can't. or until Gnome shows up. And a lot of these people will, to some degree or other, not be able to stay with the pace. What happens is when you start to crack, when your team starts to crack, just like in the Tour de France, you hear these bikers talking about, like, I cracked. Lance Armstrong, I cracked going to the Pyrenees. It was the worst day of my life. I mean, I fell out of the back of the Peloton. I was like, it took me 10 minutes longer than anybody else to get the hill, and it was the worst experience of my life. Well, it's kind of like that with the dog team, but you got another 400-some miles to go. And the wise driver, what happens, starts to back off. And this is what I'm trying to say about people need to understand this, that it isn't – when we talk about, like, say someone's dog team cracks, and I say, well, Hugh cracked, or I say Lance cracked. This hasn't happened, but I'm just saying if I did, well, I'm not talking about them. They're just as sparky as ever. I mean, they're ready to go. It's their dog team I'm talking about. So you really have to understand, the audience has to understand, this is all about the dog team. You can't make them go if they don't want to go. The wise driver feels this crack, these fractures. This is why all these drivers stop in Takata for the 24s, even though most of them plan to go much further. They all feel these fractures starting to, like, shift, and the tectonic plates and their team starting to shift, going, whoa, that's pretty ominous feeling. So they back off and they take their 24s. And then they feel pretty good. The teams feel good after 24, and then they're bolting to, you know, the points further north. And then some of them, you'll see them start to drop off. I suspect this is happening to Mike Williams Jr. We've seen him doing some kind of funny stuff back there, going from being a front runner to staying in Shagluck and then only going 30 miles, and now he stopped in Anvik, if I've got that correct. Well, those are signs of cracking. And the driver, what the driver's doing at that point is they're trying to avoid a quit scenario. Okay, so let me just take this.
Go ahead, Jason.
Let me take it a little further. So we go up to the quit. We go up to the team. You know, I know what you're getting at. The team that says, I do not want to go anymore. I'm just going to stop out here in the middle of nowhere, correct?
Right.
Know what you're getting at? Okay,
yeah.
Well, it's happened to some of the best drivers in the business. I had it happen to me on the Kuskokwim 300 back in 04. It was my wife actually has a pretty funny story about how – I didn't think it was funny at the time, but she has a pretty funny story she tells about. I'll try to put that up on the blog. But my team cracked on the Cusco in 04, and I was – I mean, they stopped on, like, the backside of the dark side of the moon. It was a horrible place to stop. I was not prepared for it. And I had to just sit there for 4 or 5 hours and let them kind of recharge their batteries so I could sort of – I could just kind of, like – muddle my way 20 miles to the next checkpoint. Now, there's a much more dramatic example. Didi Genro's team, I mean, one of the most decorated and respected mushers in the field, her dog team shut down on her in the very region drivers are going through now, which I believe it was outside of Grayling. She went about 7-8 miles out of Grayling, and her team quit. She sat there for, I mean, it must have been almost a day, and they had to go back and get her with a plane. I mean, they got a Beaver in there, and they load up her whole team and took them home. Hugh just came. That's one of the reasons I refer to coming out of the shadow of Eagle Summit. I mean, his team quit at Eagle Summit. And what happens is you are with these in the last quest, with these epic runs that drivers make, you're really rolling the dice. I mean, that's why I use a phrase like you're handing this loaded gun back and forth, is because when things go bad, they can go all the way bad to the point where your team just says, no, I am not going another step further. In Didi's case, this was back in like the mid-90s, late 90s. It was on the Yukon in a headwind. They didn't want to go into that. In Hugh's case, here just a few weeks ago, it was a headwind, a nasty, I mean, just god-awful kind of wind on Eagle Summit, which is this infamous sort of legendary terrain feature, which, you know, it's tough to get over with a fresh dog team, much less one that's having, you know, fatigue issues. And I think as terrible as it is for the driver, it's kind of a good news for all of the fans who need to understand, you know, all this talk about making dogs go and all this stuff, it's a bunch of baloney. If they don't want to go, they don't go, and you can't make them go. That's it, period. Didi sat there for a – go ahead.
With that, Jason, what are the mushers seeing for people that are involved in sprint racing and things where their dogs are just running around on a track of 4, 5, 6, 7 miles, you know, the dogs look pretty much the same when they start as when they end. They, you know, of course, they might have some wagging tongues and things, but you keep saying that the mushers have to know when those problems are developing. What are they seeing besides possibly slowing down and things? What are some other signs?
The leaders. Look, I can't. I don't have enough time here to, you know, to try to walk people through all the steps of, you know, I assume that people have to kind of get what I'm talking about. They have to understand the connection that we build with our animals. You know, when my dogs get so much as a sore toe, I mean, Lance Mackey, one of his dogs gets so much as a blister on its paw, he can tell 80 feet in front of him by how it's running. In fact, that's probably only part of it. He can tell by just some sort of extrasensory perception. That us dog mushers have spent more time with each one of these animals is what you have to understand. They're giving us all these signals, thousands of signals being transmitted back from the dogs to the driver on a moment-by-moment basis, and some of them we process consciously, most of them we just know about, sort of we internalize. And the bottom line is that of all these thousands of signals and now these many thousands of hours we spend with these animals, we know them. And you know, just like when you push your your spouse or a relative a little too far and you realize they're just getting ready to not take it so funny, you're joking and you're ribbing so funny anymore, all the way up to when you've really upset them. And the dogs are kind of like that, but even on a more, I suspect even on a more primitive level and a much more integrated level, because you actually spend time doing things with your lead dogs, which is where a quit manifests itself in the front of your team. It's not about the back of your team. It's about the front of your team not going. It's about not having any leaders who will go. In fact, you might have dogs barking and screaming to go and wheel, but nobody wants to lead. Okay, so it's a front end issue. And what they do is they start looking back and their ears start to change. And it's about how they maybe quit eating the day before. And it's about how they come off the tug line and about that look in their eye. And more than anything, it's about this feeling that you start getting, is that you can kind of feel all the vapor, you know, like you're running on fumes. And then of course there's the tried and true ducking off the trail. You know, they start doing things like you'll be pulling into a checkpoint and going through town and passing up driveways and snowmobiles and other people, you know, like homeowners' dogs and things, as you're kind of going through some village into a checkpoint that's in the middle of it, and the dogs will be like diving under people's houses and wrapping you around snow machines and looking for any opportunity to quit. Well, when that starts happening, you know that you better back off.
And that was the point that I was trying to make, is that either conscious or subconscious communication that you have to have with your team. It's just not, you know, it is something that you have to, that takes a long time to develop. And that's where when people get on the back of the sled for the first time, they think their team's just trucking on down the road and everything is fine. And then all of a sudden things start happening and they sit back and they think, wow, what's going on here? So I wanted to paint that picture a little bit about that to some of the guys that may have been mushers for years, but they haven't been a musher or a dog driver on a race like the Iditarod, where you have to process things as you're going. That's going to take sometimes days to develop. As you mentioned, Jason, they may have not eaten well at the checkpoint before, and that's where that that limp noodle starts to happen. So I'm glad we got that out. I've had a lot of questions about that on my social media things, especially on Twitter. It's so much faster to mm-hmm. type out a quick message on Twitter than it is, you know, having a long discussion on something like Facebook. You know, we're just about out of time, and I really wanted to get to that broken sled issue. Let's keep that till tomorrow if you want,
okay.
Jason. That'll keep people interested. To end this evening, it is the seventh day of the race in terms of people being involved in the Iditarod, including the ceremonial start. So we're six nights into the race now. What's going to happen over the next 24 hours that people should pay attention to?
Well, I think that what we're seeing is the race is definitely splitting up. You know, we're going to see Dallas, Sebastian, and Hans playing that long game. I mean, it's really a patience game, and it's going to pay off. It's going to pay off in the sense they're going to do very well. I don't think it's going to pay off with a win. Another guy to kind of keep your eye on, he's back there, is Ken Anderson. He's about 12 hours off the lead pace, but I will tell you, I saw some video with him. He's back there, I hate to say on purpose, but it's part of a plan. He's not trying to win. He's trying to do really well. He says his dogs look perfect. They're running fast. They're eating like monsters. He's going to come look for him over the next, you know, 48 hours from now. He's probably going to put the hammer down and start coming up through a lot of these weakening dog teams. I was really kind of sad. You know, we're starting to see some of these teams shake apart a little bit. I'm not saying he's shaking apart. He's actually moving pretty good. Martin Boozer is doing well, but the early sense, like back in Nikolai to Katna, that he was going to kind of run away with it, you know, like his magic carpet ride was going to coalesce, and then he was going to, you know, basically just have the rocket ship ride to Nome. That's not happening. He's just one of the guys right now. He's moving good. He could win this race for all I know. He's mathematically in a good position, but I don't really get the sense that he's, you know, he's got the magical carpet ride. Of the old school drivers, the one who's kind of coming together and I think will show dominance starting now, it's probably happening right now on the GPS, is on the way to Eagle Island, is John Baker. Hugh Neff, determined, moving good. He's for real. You know, he's basically for real, and his team is moving good. And if he's not as fast as Baker, he's really darn close. Still got 12 dogs. I mean, he's going to be a player the rest of the way. Ray Raines is hanging in there. And the real story for me here is I saw the video of Ramey Smith, and I've been saying that I thought he was a wild card since he came into Nikolai, and then I started upgrading that to putting my money on him. Well, my money is on Ramey Smith right now. That kid came into 15 dogs, Anvik after this long run from Iditarod to Anvik, barking, screaming, needed three people to get him parked, and he actually like tipped over and got drugged behind his sled trying to get parked. Look, if you got a dog team that can tip you over and drag you and, you know, basically make you look like you don't know how to ride a sled at Anvik after that kind of run, and you're only a couple, you know, three, he's exactly 3 hours behind you leaving out of Anvik, you got yourself you are going to have a magic carpet ride. So right now I'm saying, boy, over the next couple of days, you watch the Smith machine start to wind up, because that's the guy to watch.
There you go, our Iditarod expert here on Mush U Huskies. We will be back tomorrow at the same time, 6 o'clock Mountain, 8 o'clock Eastern, and 4 o'clock Alaska time, the time that the race is following. Jason, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much. We'll see you tomorrow night. If you have any comments or suggestions, make sure you talk to us on Facebook or Twitter or just about anywhere. All of us are on all those social media sites. And send us a message if you want right on our Blog Talk Radio page. We'll get that and talk about it tomorrow as well. Jason, thank you very much. We'll talk to you soon. Michelle, thank you. This is Robert Forto for Mush U Huskies. We'll see you next time. Goodbye.